Hello there. Today is Monday, July 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, immigrants who've overstayed their visas in the United States are hiding out in fear of deportation. Psychologists say the impacts of migrant children detained can cause lasting emotional damage.
Later on in life, we'll very likely be experiencing more anxiety disorders, depression, conduct disorders, making it very, very difficult for them to function well socially.
Also ahead, a new Barbie doll is dressed as the alter ego of a world-famous rock star. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is wading into the rift between a group of liberal Democratic congresswomen and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but his efforts to stir the pot are drawing charges of racism. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
President Trump tweets the lawmakers should go back to the broken and crime-infested places from which they came, ignoring the fact that the women are American citizens and all but one was born in the United States. Trump was almost certainly referring to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her allies in what's become known as the Squad, Representatives Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Presley, and Rashida Tlaib. In her own series of tweets, Ocasio-Cortez denounces Trump's remarks, writing, "Mr. President, the country I come from and the country we all swear to is the United States," adding, "You are angry because you can't conceive of an America that includes us." Ben Thomas, Washington.
Well, immigrant families and their defenders were on standby on Sunday for mass deportation arrests across the United States that were threatened by President Donald Trump. New York City Council member Carlos Menchaca says the ICE enforcement has affected the community.
Summer weekend, the streets have been more quiet. The kind of community spaces like at the markets have been less frequented this weekend, so people are afraid.
Trump said on Friday that a wave of arrests of immigrants facing deportation would start over the weekend, and the multi-day operation was expected to target around 2,000 people in about 10 cities who've been ordered deported by an immigration judge but have yet to leave the country. But as immigrants stayed inside their homes and lawyers stood by to provide free legal aid, there were no reports of large enforcement operations. Meanwhile, the outrage continues to grow over crying children being held in migrant detention centers who are sick, scared, and filthy. Acting director of the Citizenship and Immigration Services Office, Ken Cuccinelli, is defending border agents in charge of housing the migrants.
They're loyal, they're compassionate, but they have a job to do, and it's a tough one and made a lot tougher when a lot of people in Congress throw the vitriol at them that they are just for doing their job and enforcing the laws.
Experts say detained migrant children who have been separated from their families and living in poor conditions at Border Patrol facilities are at risk of facing traumatic physical and mental health impacts. Joining us for that part of the story is Dr. Robert Trustman, chair of the Department of Psychology at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. Thank you for being with us, sir. So what would you say the long-term impacts could be for children being put in these situations?
It's hard to just choose one specific issue. It's such an assault on the basics of humanity, but in terms of the clinical issues, children torn from their families suffer with great anxiety, and given what they may be witnessing and experiencing, are very likely to develop subsequent problems, both emotional, cognitive, as well as behavioral.
Can you give us specifics on what that would look like for a child? Does it get worse the longer they are in that situation, or is the damage already done?
Almost certainly it will worsen with greater duration and continued exposure to trauma. In terms of emotion, when children are separated from their families, depending upon the age, it can cause real difficulties with the whole notion of attachment and how children, as they grow, are able to bond socially to others in important and meaningful ways, and to develop trust, to develop caring for others. Behaviorally, there can be everything from impulsivity to behavioral disturbances, aggression. Children who feel either abandoned or constantly scared can be very aggressive as they try to cope, or they can be very withdrawn. So whether it will be more of an internalizing experience where they feel literally worthless, just, you know, that the world has turned against them, so that they would internalize that, basically feeling that, well, if the world thinks I'm worse, then I must be worthless. So there will certainly be some who behave and react in that way. We know that children who experience a lot of trauma later on in life will very likely be experiencing more anxiety disorders, depression, conduct disorders, and making it very, very difficult for them to function well socially. And so both the emotional and behavioral traumas tend to worsen the longer children are kept in these isolating environments. And cognitive development can also be impaired, because the more you are anxious, distressed, fearful, the harder it is to concentrate, to learn. Many children, most of us, learn at early ages by play, and it can be very hard in these contexts for there to be anything resembling normal human childhood play. And I doubt that they are being provided age-appropriate education. So there are a host of things that don't even touch on what's happening to the parents who are going through forcible separation from their children.
Yeah, we're hearing, you know, stories of children hungry, scared, sick, dirty clothing for not just days, but weeks and possibly months. Do you think that those parts of the issue, besides the fact that they're basically locked up as if they were sort of prisoners, is equally as damaging, or does it all sort of play a role in the trauma to these children?
It all plays a role. It continues to be dehumanizing. It continues to violate any ethical standard, national or international. And so when any of us, but certainly children, live in these kinds of deprivation, if their family structure is intact, the families can buffer and help. Say, you know, this is a tough time, but we'll make it through this. We will find things for you. But they have no one who they trust. There is no parent there who can reassure. So there's continued fear, and there can be, again, a devaluing. And either they may ultimately devalue their own worth, or they will, depending upon their age, certainly those that are older, pubertal or adolescent, may just become extremely angry. And we may be working very effectively to create a whole cadre of people who have a genuine grievance against the United States.
What I heard you just say, that even as horrible as the conditions might be for these children, that if they had their parents or their family with them in that situation, it would make things somewhat more tolerable for them?
Yes, that's correct. Not good, but you know, the role of a parent is not only to bring food, but to create a sense of safety and to create a sense of both love, hope for the future that allows children to develop. So in these kinds of environments, which are by every standard I've read, concentration camps, where we are literally concentrating people with minimal resources and isolating them from their communities, their families, history tells us nothing good comes from this.
All right. Well, we appreciate your coming in and telling us, giving us some perspective on this. That's Dr. Robert Trustman, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Hong Kong demonstrators are again clashing with police. Hawaii's telescope construction expected to draw protesters, say police, and more than two dozen have been detained at a Moscow election protest. Also, Brexiters are blamed for the embarrassing diplomatic British ambassador cable leaks. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Million people are still under a flash flood threat after Tropical Storm Barry trudged through northwestern Louisiana on Sunday, dropping up to 15 inches of rain in some places to create life-threatening flood conditions along the Mississippi River. At a news conference, New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell said her city made it through the storm.
Tropical bands with heavy rain could continue to affect the area, with predictable rainfall totals in the 2 to 4 inch range. But what we are being told by the National Weather Service is that that doesn't mean the 2 to 4 inches within an hour.
Barry, which made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane Saturday, then quickly weakened to a tropical storm at 25 kilometers east-southeast of Shreveport, with maximum sustained winds of 65 kilometers per hour early Sunday afternoon, is bringing fears that it could devastate, or did bring fears that it could devastate, the low-lying city of New Orleans like Hurricane Katrina in 2005. But the forecast did not turn out nearly as severe, but still could cause life-threatening flooding. Joining us to talk about the efforts to just continue keeping people safe is Red Cross spokesman Justin Kern. Justin, I know that you've had 14 shelters open. How many, or how much more of a need do you expect to be called on for assistance?
We pre-deployed a lot and had set up a lot of evacuation centers. As the storm really hit in earnest, Saturday into Sunday, we had about a dozen shelters open with a shelter population of about 130 people. That has changed over the day. A few of those shelters were able to kind of wind down as people were able to get back to their homes, whether it be because of safer roads or evacuation orders were lifted. But the next stage here is kind of waiting as the rain continues, and I'm in New Orleans, so the rain still is coming down here, and we were in some other spots today, still raining pretty heavily. And how that flood plays out, the flash floods and some of the little erratic tornadoes, those things are still happening all around Louisiana and Mississippi, so a little bit of wait and see for the next day or two as far as what the needs will be and where they'll be for the next stage of dealing with Barry.
How much flooding is there so far, and do they expect that even though the storm is passing through now, you know, moving on, do they still expect that the water will continue to rise?
I think, you know, some of the problem areas, as we understand it, have peaked, such as the Mississippi River in parts. But that said, some of those areas are some of the down river and back river areas will experience flooding over the next days as kind of the waters move as they typically do. So it's a little tough to say. I know initially we saw a lot of those coastal areas that were really, really socked, had a lot of water and a lot of flooding, but a lot of those people evacuated prior. So how it plays out, not really sure. You know, that the governor of Louisiana did mention today that the worst may be yet to come over the next day, just as the kind of reality of the amount of water makes itself apparent across the state and into Mississippi as well.
Obviously, the Red Cross is going to stay down there and continue to see, you know, who is impacted and what the need is. So we're probably not at this point planning to pack up and close the shelters at this point?
Correct. Yeah, we still have plenty of shelters open and people can find, you know, they can go to redcross.org/shelters, find where the latest of those are, you know, and there's some other local shelters. We have some great local partners, each parish. A lot of the parishes have their own shelters, but Red Cross will be here as needed for the recovery here. We've got people on the ground, a great team here in Louisiana, some great people in Mississippi. And then there are people, now that the airport's back open, that are coming to fill some of the additional needs as the shelters shift, as the kind of areas where there may be feeding, remote feeding needed, or disaster assessments. We've got people coming from around the country to handle that. So the need's still here. It's just how it plays out is kind of the big question mark now. So the Red Cross will be here no matter how that plays out.
All right. That's American Red Cross spokesman Justin Kern. Thanks for giving us an update. World leaders joined French President Emmanuel Macron for the country's traditional Bastille Day parade on Sunday, aimed this year to showcase European defense cooperation. The military display comes at a time when Europe is facing key tests. Thousands packed the iconic Champs-Élysées Avenue in Paris to watch the display of military might and to catch a glimpse of Macron and the leaders and dignitaries joining him. European defense solidarity was the key message of this year's parade honoring Bastille Day, which marks the 1789 storming of the Bastille prison, a key event of the French Revolution. Joining us to talk more about it is reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, tell us all about the specifics of this year's event.
This year's Bastille Day was really something a bit different because Emmanuel Macron, the French president, wanted to push his idea of a European intervention initiative. And this is a sort of a European military cooperation, something that would bring in as many as a dozen European nations together so that they could operate outside the NATO framework. So this is really what the focus of today's parade was all about. And you saw forces from some 9 countries that were all in the original idea for this European intervention initiative taking part in the parade. It was an exceptional parade, as usual. There were 4,300 members of armed forces on parade, 196 vehicles, 237 horses, and it really was a celebration, if one can put it that way, of the idea of a European Union army, that this can come together, Europe can be united, and it can do it by showing that we'll be a modern military power, able to deter rather than to be an attacking force.
Any interesting stories come out of it?
2 really interesting stories. One was what everyone is talking about, which is the French inventor who used a flyboard above the Bastille Day Tribune. There he was on this turbo engine-powered flyboard, which is what they're saying that the French military could be using in the future, that this would allow them to have, if you like, flying logistical platforms or even an assault platform. But I think for many people, particularly at the moment, the big symbol was that they came at right at the end of the parade. You had 3 French veterans in wheelchairs brought to the Tribune. 2 of them were injured in 1944 during the liberation of Paris from the Germans. And the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the French President Emmanuel Macron, both left the stage, came down, held hands with that one particular soldier who was injured in 1944. So that was a real sign that Franco-German relations are back, they're really united, and that the past really is the past, that countries have learned from the Second World War that wars just really have to be put behind. The way ahead is reconciliation. And that photo of Angela Merkel and that French soldier who was injured liberating France is one that's going to go down in the history books.
Wow. And what was the reaction? Do you feel like it maybe created a sense of much-needed unity?
It did create unity, really, and all the time in France, pretty much since the mid to late 1980s, there's been this drive for French-German reconciliation. You've had some very powerful moments, and each French president comes along and tries to really keep that going. So you've got the feeling that France and Germany are on the same page. And also when it came to the defense side, the military side of this, Angela Merkel was talking to journalists afterwards, and she said she saw this whole Bastille Day parade and the European sense of it as a big gesture towards a European defense policy and overall the strengthening of European cooperation.
How important to the people of France is Bastille Day?
It's a huge day emotionally. One of the things that France has always criticized about is that it's one of the few European countries that has this huge military display, this military parade in the center of town through the Champs-Élysées, the main boulevard in Paris. You have to bear in mind that one of the reasons it's so important to the French is that over a period of 60 years, from the late 19th century through to the end of the Second World War, France was invaded and occupied 3 times. So it came out of the Second World War determined that it was going to use its force as a deterrent. So this is its way of saying, we were invaded. It's a real scar on our history, but we're going to make sure it's not going to happen again. And this parade is a way of not just showing the rest of the world that France is ready to defend, but also just to remind its own citizens, yes, we will defend you, we are here, and that the army is part of everyday life here in France.
All right. That is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Spider-Man Far From Home is celebrating another weekend at number one at the box office. Fresh studio-released counter-programming such as the horror movie Crawl and the action comedy Stuber barely made a dent in their earnings. But Crawl, a thriller from Paramount Pictures, did debut in third place as moviegoers await next week's Disney's blockbuster in the making, The Lion King. Joining us to talk about these two movies is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, let's start with Crawl. Looks like pretty scary kind of horror movie-ish.
This movie's really timely because, you know, Hurricane Barry is hitting the Gulf Coast right now, and Crawl is based, believe it or not, on a true story. And the story wraps around a college girl who's on the swim team who has to use her skills to help rescue her father from the basement of their house in southern Florida during a Category 5 hurricane. And you may think, well, that doesn't sound so scary. How's that a horror film? Well, they're trapped in their basement by alligators. So these alligators have crawled in there during the flooding through the storm drain. And so now when she goes to check on her father, who's not answering his phone, he's been injured by one of the gators, and she's got to use her skills as a swimmer. It's also like a ticking time clock because the basement is flooding, and they have to get past these big alligators to get out of the house. And then, of course, outside is all flooded, so there's gators everywhere. So the movie's a really fun horror film to where it's not a monster. It's not, you know, something from outer space. It's an alligator. And these things are terrifying. They're really prehistoric animals that have survived from the dinosaur age. And if you ever watch the National Geographic, these things are vicious. I mean, you don't die right away. They chomp off limbs. They spin and roll. So this is a really fun summer popcorn movie, a great thriller, only comes in at an hour and 20 minutes. It gives the thrills. It gives the chills. It is one of the best times I've had this summer.
Wow, I'm surprised to hear that. Okay, that's good. Well, we've got another animal movie that's maybe a little less scary, The Lion King. Now, I'm confused. Is this a new version or sort of a sequel, or what is this all about?
This is the original Lion King from 25 years ago, and Disney has new special effect they do called photorealism. And you may recall that they used this technique a few years ago for their live screen adaptation of The Jungle Book. And what photorealism is that these animals look like they're real animals and they're talking and they're singing. They took The Lion King and they use actual animals, even though they're computer generated. So it looks like you're really seeing, you know, a lion and you're looking at hyenas, but their mouths are moving. So my couple problems with The Lion King is, first, do we really need a remake of this? It's a shot-for-shot remake of the Disney classic. And Lion King is one of the most beloved Disney classics ever. So when you go see this, my brain had to play catch-up with the movie because I'm sitting there going, okay, now there's Timon and Pumbaa. Oh, here comes Hakuna Matata. Oh, there's Scar, the villain, and his story. So it's exactly the same movie that we've known for the last quarter century. Second thing is, the photorealism started really messing with my mind. You know, at first I was like, wow, this is a cool special effect. But then it's like, wait a minute, how are these things talking? And they have no facial expression. So unlike the animated film where you see their eyebrows and everything, they give all these emotions, these are just talking mouths. So I thought that really didn't work for me either. So those three things, I'm not excited about this film. Even though Jon Favreau directed this, he also directed Jungle Book, and he's just one of Hollywood's greatest directors. There was just nothing creative about it because it's the same old story, and the effects were just really disturbing.
This is a warm and fuzzy movie, but it doesn't sound like you really, really enjoyed it too much, huh?
It's because they're basing it on The Lion King, you know, the one that we've seen from 25 years ago. So a lot of families and adults will bring their kids. If you don't know the story of The Lion King, if you have a really young generation, they may find it interesting. But again, the photorealism makes it really disturbing because it really looks like hyenas. It looks like real warthogs and real. I don't know if it was necessary to do a photorealism of The Lion King. You know what I mean? So I'm really mixed on it. I didn't have a good time with it, no.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard. He's always honest. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. The Barbie doll has been many things over the years, and now she is dressed as Ziggy Stardust in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the release of David Bowie's iconic Space Oddity. Barbie makers at Mattel have released a collectible version of the doll dressed as Ziggy Stardust, one of his most beloved alter egos. Barbie wears the metallic Ziggy spacesuit with red and blue stripes, flared shoulders, and cherry red platform boots. The doll's hair is fiery red. The $50 limited edition doll was created in collaboration with the David Bowie Archive. The beloved rocker died in 2016 after battling cancer. He was 69. Like some cat from Japan, he could lick up my smiling. He could leave and to have. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Just the beer light to guide us. So we fixed about his pants and shut with clutches we have. Played for time, jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass. He was the mass with God-given ass. Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government. The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $1 million for information leading to the identification or location in any country of a key leader of the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization. Hamza bin Laden, son of deceased former Al-Qaeda head Osama bin Laden. Born in Saudi Arabia in the late 1980s, Hamza bin Laden has released audio and video messages on the Internet since 2015, calling for terrorist attacks against the United States and its Western allies. He has threatened attacks against the United States in revenge for the May 2011 killing of his father by U.S. service members. Hamza bin Laden is married to the daughter of Abdullah Ahmed Abdullah, an Al-Qaeda senior leader who was indicted and charged by a federal grand jury in November 1998 for his role in the August 7, 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. Letters by Osama bin Laden seized from his compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, after his death, indicate that Hamza bin Laden was being groomed to replace his father as leader of Al-Qaeda. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 individuals who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. More information about these reward offers is located on the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information on Hamza bin Laden to contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website. Email info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals may also contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential. That was an international public service announcement by the United States government. This is VOA News. I'm Tommy Mee.